we're moving into the part of the program which some would say represents high stakes communication. We've heard a lot about the work done to help judges understand groundwater, but what we're going to hear about now is a bit about what it's like to be in the witness stand and the work that goes on around that. Our next presenter is Stu Grubb. Stu is the lead expert witness in the White Bear Lake case, and he will review the challenges he encountered and the most significant arguments used in that case. He's a hydrologist. He's currently senior hydrogeologist with Emmons and Oliver Resources in Oakdale. He frequently works with law firms on lawsuits and mediation involving surface water and groundwater resources. So with that, I'd like to welcome Stu to the podium. Stu?
Judges are smart, but they need to be educated. And the same can be true of lawyers and juries. In fact, many of the audiences that we've been talking about today that we have to communicate with as hydrogeologists have the same characteristic. Very smart, but they don't have the background that they need to have in order to understand what you're talking about. And so a lot of our work is to educate them and to get our point across. The White Bear Lake case was probably one of the most significant legal cases involving groundwater in Minnesota in the last 15 or 20 years. I was privileged to be in the middle of it as lead technical expert for the plaintiffs in the case of this. The plaintiffs were the White Bear Lake Restoration Association, and they were a group of business owners and other concerned citizens that lived and worked near the lake for really their entire lives. They sued the DNR under the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act, or MIRA. One of the big advantages of the MIRA law is that you can sue either a company or a governmental unit or an individual that you feel is harming the environment, and you don't have the burden to demonstrate that you are personally harmed by that action, just that the environment is going to be harmed. And the talk that's following this by Katie Crosby Lehman will no doubt go into more detail about MIRA and that, and how that lawsuit was brought. So the lawsuit claimed that DNR had harmed the environment by failing to protect White Bear Lake against the loss of water due to overpumping of groundwater below the lake. You know, the lawsuit was never really about money. Obviously, some of the plaintiffs had a financial interest in the outcome of the case. Business values and home values were falling as fast as the water levels in the lake were falling. But even recovery of legal, but there was no monetary damages that were sought in the case. And even the recovery of legal fees wasn't an issue because the Cerisi Conlon law firm was doing all the work on a pro bono basis. So most of the folks that were supporting the lawsuit were really only interested in getting their lake back and getting back the recreational values that that they had grown to love. I'm not going to talk a lot about kind of the background geology and even the history of the White Bear Lake lawsuit. I know that Jason Meckel has presented that at other talks here at the MGWA. You've probably heard Paul Putzier talk about it in other venues. They've both had kind of a roadshow, the DNR roadshow that's been going on around the Twin Cities, explaining what the DNR has been doing with White Bear Lake since the lawsuit happened. This is really one of the first times that we as the plaintiff side have had a chance to give our side of the story, as it were, or at least to present things from this perspective. It's the first time that the lawyers have let me off the leash, as it were, to go and talk about the case, even though it's still pending in the courts and is going to be heard by the Minnesota Supreme Court here in the near future. When I started talking to Kate Pound about making a presentation at the conference, she explained to me that the theme of the conference was presenting technical information to non-technical technical audiences, and she thought the White Bear Lake lawsuit would be a good case study of the expert witness process and how one goes about explaining technical issues to a non-technical audience. and in this case, namely, a judge. So that's what I'm going to focus on, and I assume that everyone has kind of a basic understanding of what the stratigraphy of the Twin Cities area is and has a little bit of knowledge about surface water and groundwater interactions. But I do, however, want to set the stage for where we were in 2013 and 2016 when we were getting ready for the trial. So this is a hydrograph of White Bear Lake elevations between 1925 and 2015. And as it shows, we had enjoyed a relatively stable White Bear Lake for many years, even decades, until sometime in the 1980s when it started to take a precipitous drop. Thank you. So in the 1980s when it took this rather precipitous drop. Now, that period corresponded to the drought period of late 1980s. And in the early 90s, it started to rain again, and water levels came back up. And it was assumed that that's the way things were going to work. Well, then in 2003, water levels started to drop again, and by 2013, we were experiencing some of the lowest water levels that had ever been recorded. In fact, the lowest water level that had ever been recorded, even lower than the periods of during the 1930s. And we were seeing images like, this is some kind of cruel justice, because I really do have a slide later in the program that talks about the importance of being prepared with your audio visuals and how it and how it can really affect your credibility when those things don't work. So it must have been karma. So in 2003 through 2013, we were starting to see images like this come from White Bear Lake, where we're seeing boats are high and dry. We had receding shorelines and extended docks that people had to extend hundreds of feet just to get out to the water. The marinas that were dependent on renting out slips for the season could no longer do so because of low water levels, and we had cattails and we had trees growing in places where they had never grown before. And then the public beaches were, many of them are closed. So it really illustrates that one of the key problems with this was the recreational value of the lake and how that was being degraded. We looked at the environmental effects from many different perspectives, and really couldn't identify any serious environmental issues. And we found that if the lake had gotten much lower, that there could have been some permanent changes to the plants and the vegetation along the edge and on the bottom of the lake, or there could have been an effect on fish populations. But at least within the water level ranges that we had seen, we couldn't identify a real serious ecological problem. It was really all about the recreational value of the lake. So, going back to the hydrograph, there's some things that you need to be aware of when you're looking at this. The first is that from 1912 to 1978, White Bear Lake actually augmented, the city of White Bear Lake augmented the lake level with wells that were located along the shore of the lake. And they pumped water out of the aquifer and back into the lake. And of course, that just went back into the aquifer, and it was a vicious cycle. Eventually, they realized that that was probably not a real efficient way of doing things. And in 1978, they discontinued that practice. But it did maintain fairly stable water levels through that period. In 1987 through 1991, we had some drought years, low precipitation, and that preceded the very low levels that were observed in the late 1980s and late 1990s, or early 1990s. And then 1991 through 1995, we had a rainfall and a recovery of the lake. And so everybody was happy again for a few years, until in 2003, approximately, and through 2016, the water level started to decrease again rapidly, probably due to the drought that was in the early 2000s. Except the problem was there wasn't a drought in the early 2000s. Actually, rainfall levels had been fairly close to normal, and yet we were seeing these drops in water levels. And so, many people at that time were saying that gee, the drop in the water level is just due to climatic cycles, and this is nothing unusual. They pointed to other lakes in the area, other rivers in the area, saying that, they're going through these same cycles too. It's nothing to be concerned about. Even hydrologists and hydrogeologists were well-respected, and people that I still respect today were saying that pumping was not having a significant influence on White Bear Lake. But there were some statistics to suggest otherwise. This time it was different, and that's what the locals were saying, is that this time it's different. There's something else going on with the lake. When the USGS did this study of looking at water levels and versus the cumulative precipitation over time and the variances from the normal, we saw that they could make a pretty good fit to their model from the 80s through to the early 2000s. But then in about 2003, things started to change. And even though you had close to average or even above average rainfall level, water levels were starting to drop. Another exercise that they did looked at linear regression models and showed a similar result. And it kind of determined that if it weren't for the pumping that was going on below White Bear Lake, that the water level really should be about 3.5 feet higher than it was, based on rainfall levels that had been observed. So the main suspect into what was going on and why things were not the way they used to be was pumping from the Prairie du Chien Aquifer. And this graph showed the cumulative pumping of, pumping records from the water appropriation permit wells in the Prairie du Chien Aquifer, again, from the 1980s through the early 2000s. And we had seen a steady increase in pumping as the cities had grown and as water use continued to increase. So the top black line shows pumping from all the aquifers below White Bear Lake, and the gray line just below that shows just the Prairie du Chien pumping. So that was by and far the largest source of drinking water for the cities around White Bear Lake. Now, an interesting part of this graph in the last years there from about 2003 through 2010, pumping had actually leveled off quite a bit. It had even decreased in, if you looked at it in some of the later years, and yet White Bear Lake was starting to fall. It seemed like we had reached some sort of a tipping point at 2003 where we had reached the sustainable level of pumping that could be handled by the aquifer, and now we were doing, we were going beyond that, and we were having an adverse effect on the water levels. So the question is that had DNR allowed too much pumping via the appropriation permits that it had, and therefore had some responsibility for the low levels in White Bear Lake. The DNR had done a study back in the 90s that concluded that White Bear Lake was indeed connected to the aquifer below it, that there was a significant amount of groundwater in White Bear Lake, that there was a lot of exchange between the aquifer and the lake, and that also if the aquifer were pumped enough, that there would be significant drawdowns in White Bear Lake. By today's standards, it was a relatively simple study, but it was completed in 1998, and that was about the time that water levels started to rebound, and so the report really didn't get a lot of attention. It was more or less put on the shelf and not pulled out for many more years. In 2013, USGS then completed a study that was more in response to the low water levels of the early and mid-2000s. Here they confirmed a lot of the findings of the 1998 report. They had a lot more data. They had more methods to analyze that data, particularly for the surface water groundwater interactions. So they came to similar conclusions that pumping below White Bear Lake could have a significant impact on the water levels. But being the USGS, that's not good enough. They had to continue to study it. And then in 2016 came out with a second report. The 2016 report had more direct measurements of groundwater inflow into and out of White Bear Lake, It had geophysical studies of the bottom of the lake, had detailed data on evapotranspiration, and it had a mod flow groundwater model that simulated the lake and pumping in the aquifer below that. And so really this kind of represented another turn of the hydrogeological cycle, as we call it. Now, I'll explain what I mean. We're probably all familiar with the hydrologic cycle, as it's explained in most textbooks, and it's illustrated here with, again, a USGS figure showing a hydrologic cycle around White Bear Lake. So we have precipitation falls on the ground, either infiltrates as groundwater or runs off as surface water into the lake. Then there is evaporation from the lake, water goes back in the atmosphere, and the cycle starts again. This was the hydro-illogical cycle that was going on with White Bear Lake. And it kind of starts down here in the lower right corner with apathy, you know, when the water levels are about where they are expected to be. Then there's a drought, a lot of awareness and concern, and eventually panic until it rains again, and then you're back to apathy. And in the case of White Bear Lake in the 1980s, early 80s, we were at apathy. Then there was the drought of the late 80s, which rose awareness and concern into the 1990s, and then panic until it started to rain again, and we got back to apathy. Then we went around again in the early 2000s, where there wasn't a drought, but there was at least awareness and concern, and eventually panic when the water levels got really low. Now, interesting epilogue to the whole hydrologic cycle is that in the last 3 years, we've had either record or near record rain, and now White Bear Lake is full and overflowing back into, its, or beyond its overflow point that goes back into White Bear Lake. So I still believe that in my lifetime, we're gonna go around this cycle again. Eventually, there's gonna be a drought. There's gonna be awareness, concern, and panic, and probably rainfall again, at least I hope. But it'll be interesting to see how we respond the next time it comes up. So with all this work that was done by USGS, you know, why weren't they the ones that were on the witness stand instead of a consultant? Well, it turns out it takes almost an act of Congress, literally, to get the USGS to be involved in a lawsuit like this. You can't just call up the USGS and say, let's take these people who are working on something else. They're not going to work on that now. They're going to spend the next several weeks or months working on this lawsuit. If you want to have something like that happen, you usually have to have a senator or congressman contact the USGS in Washington, get the approval from the director there to say that, yeah, these people need to be stopped doing whatever other project they're doing and go work on the case. So instead, they're left with hiring a consultant like myself. And one of the first things that the lawyers had me do was go out and do my own independent study of White Bear Lake. And I had done some of that in the past through, you know, work on surface water, groundwater interactions in Washington and Ramsey County. But I was doing things like going out on the lake and collecting water samples for water quality. I put in some temporary piezometers along the lake shore to measure whether you know, head levels indicated that water was coming into the lake or going out of the lake, and collected water samples from some of the wells in the area. And the only reason that I sort of questioned, well, why do I have to do all this? Why do I have to kind of do a mini study of what USGS was doing? And I think one of the main reasons was just so that when you're on the witness stand, you have the credibility that it takes to address the questions from the defense. So it was also that the defense couldn't stand there and ask me, Mr. Grubb, have you ever been to White Bear Lake? You know, do you even know what it looks like? And I could say with a straight face, yes, I've been there, and I've done my own studies, and I'm very familiar with the lake and how it operates. We had some kind of comical situations when we were taking water samples from the wells. You know, normally you would just call up the public utility if you were, you know, taking something from a city well, and you would set up a time to go collect the sample. Well, once you do that, the other side wants to be there because they don't want to feel like they're missing out on anything. So then you'd have to coordinate their side to make sure that we all got to the well at the same time. And it was often it was myself, it was somebody from Pace Analytical who was going to collect the water sample from the other side, And it was the guy from the utility who had opened the door for us and showed us where the spigot was that we were going to take it. And then there was about five or six lawyers standing around. And, you know, this has all been a lot of logistics to get everybody together. And so once everybody was all set, the guy from Pace would go over and he'd fill a small bottle from the spigot. And then I would go over and I'd fill a small bottle from the spigot. And then we'd all go home. And so it was a lot of that kind of work, just getting prepared for the trial. So I wanted to kind of give you an idea of how the trial was set up and what kind of things happened. So first I want to describe how the room was set up. It was very much like typical courtroom that you see on Law and Order, or if you see on old Perry Mason reruns, where you have at the front of the room a judge and a law clerk, or a legal clerk. The judge in this case was Margaret Marinin, a well-respected judge who had been on the bench for many years. In fact, she had made it clear that this was going to probably be the last case that she heard before she retired. So she wanted to make sure that she got it right. She didn't really care whose ox was going to be gored by the decision, and you know whether it got appealed and got overturned on appeal. That wasn't so much of a current concern. She just wanted to make this very much a part of her legacy that that she had studied this carefully and had rendered a good decision. And the legal clerk, I don't know all of his responsibilities, but he's basically the secretary for the judge. And he keeps keeps a schedule, tells people when things are going to happen, and does a lot of other duties that that I don't really fully understand. Then to the left of the judge was a witness stand. And in front of the witness stand was a court recorder. And the court recorder's job is to take notes and to keep track of the official transcript of the trial. So they're there with the legal recorder typing constantly, keeping track of everything that had been said. Then in front of the court reporter, there were two tables, one for the lawyers, plaintiff's lawyers, and one for the defendant's lawyers, and they kind of faced each other. And then off to the side was another area for other lawyers that were either observing the case or tangentially involved involved with the case. And towards the back of the room was the audience, and in the audience was usually a few people who were interested from the plaintiff's side of it, a few who were observers from the defendant's side. There was often one or two newspaper reporters in the audience, and a few others from state agencies and so on who were kind of curious about what was going on. So the way the trial started was that there are opening statements from both sides, and those take a few days. And then eventually they get to the expert witness testimony. And when it came my turn to give my testimony, we were ready. I mean, Katie Crosby, Layman, and I had, were well prepared. She had a list of questions that she knew she was going to ask. And the way this works is the lawyer asks the questions and then I would respond. And so I knew what she was going to ask. She knew the answers that I was going to give. It was all, we were ready to go. And so it started out right away that, she asked basic questions. Who are you? What do you do? How long have you been doing this? Where are you from? And we were bing, bing, bing. We were going and going and going. And we had started late in the day, and came 5 o'clock, we had to stop. So we came back the next day, and the first thing the judge said to us, she kind of wagged her finger and says, "You got to slow down." She says, you're driving the court reporter nuts. She can't keep up with you, and I'm having a tough time keeping up with you. So that was one of the first lessons we learned is you got to slow down. You need to take your time to explain to people, explain to the judge, and explain to others in the courtroom what you're really doing. But we were, as I said, very well prepared, and that was an important part of this. I've testified at other trials with lawyers that were not so well prepared. In one case, a lawyer asked me a question, and I knew the response they wanted to give me, and I knew what the truth was, and that was something else. So, being under oath, I answered with the truth, and he got a kind of an ashen look on his face. And it really took the wind out of the testimony and the wind out of the trial. So, you know, another thing is that you want to be aware of is always be very well prepared. Now, the object of what we were doing was to educate the judge. So we needed to give her all of the background on kind of the undisputed parts of the case so that she would have a good foundation to understand the more complicated parts that were coming later and that, you know, that were somewhat disputed. So we started literally from the ground up, you know, talking about how the stratigraphy of the Twin Cities area developed. And so we went all the way back to, you know, Precambrian 500 million years ago and explained that, you know, layers of sandstone were built up, that there was a shallow sea that covered southeast Minnesota. We explained what the Hollandale embayment was and where that was. And then the judge asked me a question at one point. She said, does this have related to that Lake Agassiz up in northern Minnesota? It kind of caught me off guard. And I said, well, I'm not sure, I'll have to get back to that, and went on and on. And then later it occurred to me that she was talking about Glacial Lake Agassiz up in northern Minnesota, which she had heard of before. And I went back and I said, no, ma'am, we're still 200 million years ago. Lake Agassiz was more, you know, 10,000 years ago kind of thing. We'll get there eventually, but, you know, good question. We explained, how the Prairie du Chien aquifer was formed, and how it relates to the glacial deposits above it, and how White Bear Lake interacts with the aquifer. Just a quick bit of background on the hydrogeology. The Prairie du Chien aquifer is the main drinking water aquifer for the area around White Bear Lake. Generally, as it shows in this picture with the contours and arrows all over it, White Bear Lake is kind of there in the middle. You can, a little bit difficult to see, but you can kind of make it out. This also shows that up to the northwest in Anoka County, the aquifer starts to thin out, and is eroded away. It doesn't really exist up in that area. Same is true off to the east in the St. Croix Valley there. But groundwater flow is generally from northwest to southeast. This was a key part of the analysis of White Bear Lake and the groundwater surface water interactions. This was put together by the USGS, and I thought that this was a very good illustration that explained a scientific principle. They were looking at the stable isotope analysis, that is the ratio of deuterium and O18 in groundwater samples that were collected. And, you know, based on that ratio, you can determine that whether some of the water was at some time exposed to evaporation, and therefore has a signature of being surface water. This showed that a circle for each of the samples that was collected, very easy to understand. The ground part of the brown part of the circle represents the groundwater component. The blue part represents the surface water component. And I think anybody can see that up to the northeast of White Bear Lake, you have very little surface water in the samples. As you get down to the southwest part and wells that are located southwest of the lake, you start to see more and more surface water in those samples, which presumably came from White Bear Lake, presumably leaked out of White Bear Lake. The problem with this particular analysis in this particular figure was that it was often misinterpreted. People that were interested in putting the blame for low levels in White Bear Lake on the wells and the municipal wells, particularly to the southwest of White Bear Lake, would say, look, you know, this demonstrates here. They're sucking the water out of the lake. You know, you've got more blue in those circles, and that's where the water is going. And the people in those communities were saying, no, you got that all wrong. That water's already been there, now it's out of the lake. The real culprit is the folks that are up to the northeast of the lake, places like Hugo. You know, they're sucking all the water out of the aquifer before it ever gets to the lake, and it's their problem. So we took a look at this and said, you know, we're looking at this in the wrong perspective. People need to understand, you know, how pumping a well really affects the lake. And we wanted to explain that you can go in any direction, whether it's up gradient, down gradient, or off to a side gradient, or whether it's northeast, west, and south from the lake. And if you are pumping enough and you are creating a cone of depression that extends underneath the lake, you are having an effect on the aquifer and you are affecting the water level in the lake above it. So I wanted to, this was also another figure from a later report by the USGS where they kind of expanded that out, expanded the area where they were taking the samples, but it still shows the same trend of more surface water influence as you go down gradient from White Bear Lake. Well, I did an exercise where I looked at the effect of individual wells on White Bear Lake. And these were the pumping wells that had water appropriation permits, the, you know, the largest pumpers. And I looked at all the wells within a 5-mile radius of White Bear Lake. And this was a simple spreadsheet exercise. The legal team kind of questioned why I was doing this. You know, why are you looking as far as 5 miles away from the lake? You know, that seems like it's awfully far. We'd been much more focused on just the towns of White Bear Lake and White Bear Township and Badness Heights and so on. And, you know, and why are you looking in all directions? You know, do you really need to do this? And I said, well, just let me try it. I want to see what the results are. And it'll only take me a little bit of time. Ended up taking me and a colleague about 2 days to get it all done. And it was really, as I mentioned, a spreadsheet model where we just used a simple Tice equation. We got the parameters for hydraulic conductivity from the Metro model. We took just literature values for storage coefficient. And we wanted to see just in a relative sense which wells were having the greatest effect. And somewhat to our surprise, I should say not to our surprise, first of all, was that the municipal pumping wells that were to the southwest of the lake were having a significant effect on the drawdown of the lake. What was surprising was that some of the wells that were right on the edge of that 5-mile radius were some of the largest pumpers and were having some of the most drawdown on the lake. So, you know, very similar to Mike, the last speaker, who had big red dots where they're having the most effect and smaller green dots where there's less effect, we put together this this graphic or this figure. Now the biggest pumping wells that were there about 5 miles out and to the southwest of the lake were owned by the St. Paul Water Utility and the Water Supply Utility. They had been put in the early 2000s to control temperature at the plant. Now, those of you that don't know, the St. Paul Water Utility gets its water from the Mississippi River up upstream and north of the Twin Cities, brings it through a series of pipes and open channels and lakes down to the water treatment plant there in St. Paul. And something that I had learned only recently was that the reason they put these pumps in was to blend the water and actually warm it up, not cool it down. Usually think, oh, they want to cool the water down because you get less corrosion of pipes and so on with the cooler water in the summertime. But the real issue was that in the wintertime, the very cold water that was coming from the surface was interfering with their chlorine reactions and their disinfection process. And they were getting very inconsistent water and having a difficult time controlling those chemical reactions. So they put in these wells to essentially warm the water up. Now, you know, they pumped a tremendous amount of water. So even though they were fairly far away from the lake, they were still having a significant effect. In fact, we did a similar exercise again to what Mike was talking about. We looked at all of the top, wells that were having the most effect, and we found that there was about 8 wells that were responsible for maybe 40% of the drawdown in the water level below the lake. And the St. Paul Water Utility had 4 or 5 of those wells. Interestingly enough, those wells were started in about 2003, which I remember was when we started to see the deviation of lake levels to rainfall. Now, I'm not making an association there, and please don't go and tell the water utility that I said it was their fault that White Bear Lake was being diminished, but it was an interesting coincidence. And also, since the trial has happened, the water utility has stopped using those wells. They've stopped pumping from the wells. And I haven't gotten an explanation for why that was, but perhaps one interesting outcome of the trial. I should also say that, you know, the 5-mile radius, we'll hear more about that later, was not an entirely arbitrary decision. Felt that beyond, if you got beyond 5 miles away from the lake, that you would be getting into wells that were more influenced by the Mississippi River on the west and the St. Croix River on the east. You go up more than 5 miles to the northeast, you start to get into the areas where the Prairie du Chien has eroded away and not used as a drinking water source. So I wanted to have something that, again, illustrated that it doesn't matter what side of the lake you're on, you're still going to be having an effect, but I wanted to keep it a reasonable distance. Another thing that came out of the trial was the results of the USGS groundwater model and the mod flow model. And this was completed just days before the trial started, and it really ended up being significant. But one of the interesting things is that this is all we had. You know, this was the only result that we had to present at the trial and present to the judge. And it was very simple. All it explained was that if you were to take all of the wells that had water appropriation permits around White Bear Lake and decrease their permitting by 30%, the level of the lake would increase by about 1.5 feet. Similarly, if you increase the pumping by 30%, water level would decrease by about 1.5 feet. Kind of ties back to some of the earlier work that USGS had had done. And this also says that that effect can be seen whether the lake is at a very high elevation or at a very low elevation. And that's all it said. You know, we didn't have all of the fancy graphics. We didn't have bars moving across the screen that showed, you know, how different wells were affecting the surface water levels. You know, later results that DNR took this model and continued to develop it. They made it into a transient model. And you've probably heard Jason Meckel give the story. But they've ran all sorts of different scenarios at for different times, different water levels, different pumping rates, and had a lot of very interesting graphics to show. But this is all we had. And really, I think that we relied on the simplicity of these results and kind of the credibility of the USGS, saying, well, if the USGS did it, you know, we know that they really scrutinize everything that they do, and they're very, very often correct. So you need to trust these model results. We can also kind of paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, the former defense secretary at the time of the Iraq War, who famously said that you don't go to war with the army that you wish you had, you go to war with the army that you have. And to paraphrase that is, you don't go to trial with the model that you wish you had, you go to trial with the model that you had. So although the results were very simplistic, I think they were still effective. Another graph that was important was groundwater pumping by month for different cities around White Bear Lake. And this graph, everybody in the room should be familiar with it. This is, I think, the shame of Minnesota, that almost all municipalities pump far more water in the summer months than they do in the winter months. In fact, it's 2 to 4 times as much on a monthly basis in the summertime. And the reason for that is strictly for turf irrigation, lawn watering. So we take one of our best resources, one of the purest sources of water we have, and we throw it out on the lawn in the summer months where it evaporates. It also gives me hope in that knowing that through some fairly basic conservation measures, we can reduce the water that we use by 30% or more just by restricting lawn watering. So one of the things that came up then as part of the trial was that the DNR had established, really shortly before the trial started, a protective elevation on White Bear Lake of 922 feet. When the lake dropped, that means that when the lake drops below that point, The DNR is allowed to restrict its appropriation permits and decrease appropriations so that we don't do further harm to the lake. Our argument was that that level should have been higher. In fact, it should have been more like 923.5. If you want to preserve the recreational value of the lake, you can't wait until the lake has bottomed out. You have to start taking action before it gets to that point. And we argued that this was a safe elevation where you could start implementing things like lawn watering bans in order to avoid those steep valleys that really influenced how the lake could be used. So the decision that came down, there's many aspects of it, but I just want to touch on a few of the key ones. The first part of the decision was that groundwater pumping near White Bear Lake is unsustainable and is causing the drawdown of White Bear Lake. And that's the decision that the judge reached, you know, based on all of the testimony that was presented to her. There could be no new or increased water appropriation permits within 5 miles of White Bear Lake. There again, the 5 miles radius came up, and that was the only reason I think was there was because I did that one calculation way back when, and I had five fingers on my left hand, and so I picked a 5 mile radius, which wasn't entirely arbitrary, but you know, still, it ended up being a key part of the decision. Now, also the DNR must develop a sustainable pumping plan and adjust appropriation permits to meet that sustainable goal, and that's ongoing through the cities putting together their water supply plans for the future and working very closely with the DNR to meet a plan where each city pumps roughly 70 gallons per person per day, which was kind of set as a target elevation for what might be sustainable over the long term. And then also there was the 923.5 trigger elevation for the lawn watering ban, which was instituted. Now, regardless of how the Supreme Court case comes out and whether this all gets overturned or not, I think a lot of this is going to stand anyway. I mean, the appeals and so on were based almost strictly on legal details of the case and how the case was presented. There wasn't a lot of argument over whether or not the technical parts of this were correct. Even if the case is overturned, I don't think that the DNR is going to go back to suggesting that groundwater pumping has no effect on White Bear Lake. I don't think that they're going to go back on requiring the various cities to come up with sustainable water plans. You know, that's that wheel's in motion, and I think it will continue. You know, there may be questions about whether they have to enforce the 923.5 trigger elevation for the lawn watering ban and a few details like that. But I feel that progress was made by the lawsuit. Now, the last image I want to show is one of my favorites that came from the trial. And it kind of illustrates the importance of having good people presenting, doing your presentations. There's people out there who know how to make charts and graphs, who know how to make videos, if that's necessary, better than you do. And I'm comfortable about saying that about all of us. And we should definitely take advantage of those folks whenever they can, because it's a great help in presenting the information that you want to present. This cartoon ran in the Star Tribune a day or two after the decision was handed down. It was by Steve Sack, the Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist for the newspaper. I really like it because the image of Judge Marinan is dead on. She looks exactly like that. I don't know that he really fully understood the groundwater surface water interactions and the subtlety of the hydrology there, but it does give a good summary of what the trial was about. So with that, I think I have time for a few questions.
I'm Rich Soule. I'm filling in for Kelton.
You're Rich.
From the health department. This is maybe off point, but it's a question that came to mind. A few years ago, I had the painful experience of going through Minnesota water law And one of those things that you see in Minnesota water law is a set of priorities for dependent upon the use. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if that ever entered into the discussion here.
Yes, it did.
Because this, you know, water lake levels is kind of low on the list.
Right, right. You know, top priority in that list is drinking water supply, I believe. And it goes down to industrial uses, and then I don't even recall where exactly you know, lake levels and surface water interactions fit on that list. So I guess the short answer is yes, it was considered. How did it affect the decision? Can't come up with a real good explanation of that. Maybe Katie remembers better.
Just briefly add that we made sure that the relief we were requesting would not impinge on any of the upper level of the water use priorities. It only impacted the very bottom one, which was, I'm drawing a blank on the word now, but basically it was preventing irrigation, which right. is a non-essential water use. And so none of the relief requested impacted any ongoing water use needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said you had to make a decision whether to tell the truth or to give the answer that was expected. Did you want to elaborate on that, or is that kind of like pushing you too far?
It was actually not a real technical question. It was more about contract arrangements between myself and the lawyers. And it asked me if I had an ongoing contract with them, and I said, no, I don't, which was the truth. And he said he didn't want that answer. He wanted to say, that, yes, we're continuing to study this. And so, you know, it doesn't seem like it was all that significant, except that it just took the wind out of our sails at the time.